that kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. Derek, let's start with this discussion about a potential Iranian attack on Israel, which there's been a lot of rumors over the past few days. As of the time of recording, no attack has occurred, but what has been going on?
I'm not sure excited is how I would characterize it, but yes, the U.S. and Israel have been commiserating for several days now about the possibility of an imminent Iranian attack on either Israel directly or Israeli interests in the Middle East, in response, of course, to the Israeli strike that hit what the Iranians claim, at least. The U.S. is kind of hedging about this, but the Iranians say was a consular building attached to their embassy in Damascus earlier this month. That was on April 1st, that killed a number of Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps figures, including a senior general.
Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, repeated his promise to retaliate.
In this case, the wicked regime made a mistake. It must be punished, and it will be punished.
U.S. and Israel have basically been waiting for the other shoe to drop as a result of that attack, waiting for the Iranians to fulfill the repeated promises they have made to retaliate for it. There was some thinking toward the end of last week that a retaliatory strike might be imminent. They were looking at Friday because it was the last Friday in the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. That seemed like a candidate for a response. It didn't happen on Friday. Then attention shifted toward Eid al-Fitr, the holiday that marks the end of Ramadan. There was some thinking that there might be a strike to coincide with Eid. That didn't happen either. Eid was Wednesday, I believe, in Iran and most countries around the world. So, I mean, it's a multi-day thing, but still, if you were thinking that that was going to be the day, that then you would have thought probably Wednesday something would have happened. There's still, however, according to a number of outlets, Bloomberg reported this on Wednesday, I believe, and there have been a number of other outlets that have reported similar things. The Biden administration still thinks that a strike is imminent. The commander of the U.S. Military Central Command, General Eric Kurilla, went to Israel on Thursday, apparently to coordinate a potential response to an Iranian action, or to coordinate, kind of get everybody on the same page in the event of some kind of Iranian action. He had already been scheduled to go, I guess, to talk about that humanitarian aid pier, the U.S. military's latest boondoggle in Gaza. That's a discussion, I guess, is off the table right now as they focus on this potential response. There's still no consensus on what form the response might take, and it largely depends on whether the Iranians are itching for a bigger fight or not. And I think what we've seen over the last 6 months strongly suggests that they are not, which probably means that if there's a response that does come, it will come proportionate to what happened on April 1st. So the Iranians will target an Israeli diplomatic facility of some kind or some sort of Israeli interest outside of Israel proper. However, Kurilla is in Israel, and it sounds like they are preparing for the absolute worst case scenario, which would be a large kind of barrage of missiles and or drones fired by Iran and probably its regional partners, Hezbollah, various militias in Iraq, etc., toward Israel itself. That kind of retaliation would almost certainly mean that we're headed to a bigger war. It would be very difficult to contain this conflict at that point. If the Iranians respond in some way that is less than that, there is still probably room for the Israelis to get off the path to war, although there's no indication at this point that they want to. Nevertheless, the Biden administration has reportedly been doing a number of things to try and tamp this down. They've been passing notes in study hall to Tehran, basically through some intermediaries. The governments of Iraq, Qatar, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, all of whom are trusted U.S. partners, but have some relationship with Iran and some ability to pass messages. They've apparently been doing that. They've asked the German government. The German government may, of its own accord, have kind of publicly said, you know, we're calling on the Iranians to be restrained. But I think maybe the Biden administration might have asked the German government to do that. Germany does also have a relationship with Iran. Even the Russian government has issued a statement, which I'm sure was not coordinated with the Biden administration, kind of urging the Iranians to temper whatever they do next. There's probably some discussion, especially with Kirilla in Israel, about tempering the Israeli response to whatever Iran does actually do. Although, as I said, if there is a maximal response that includes an attack on Israel from Iran, so something that doesn't even have the sort of plausible deniability of like it was Hezbollah that did it or it was a militia that did it. But if it comes from Iran and they attack Israel directly, it's going to be, I think, impossible to contain that.
Thanks, Eric, for the grim update. As always, speaking of grim updates, let's move on to Gaza and give us an update on the ceasefire talks.
Yeah, they're not going well. There was a renewed ceasefire, a renewed round of ceasefire talks that resumed earlier this week in Cairo with full attendance, which was a promising sign. The Israeli government sent a delegation. Hamas was there. They weren't talking to each other directly, but Hamas was in Cairo to participate. The Qataris, as always, the Egyptians, as always, and the United States, the administration sent William Burns, the CIA director / de facto Secretary of State, as it has been doing throughout these talks. What was interesting, in addition to the full attendance, was a lot of reporting earlier this week out of Cairo suggested that the Biden administration, in the wake of last week's World Central Kitchen drone strike that really seemed to have made Joe Biden performatively mad, and in light of this kind of looming threat from Iran, or threat that this could escalate finally into a much bigger regional conflict, had been at least taking the lead in the talks in a way that was not necessarily apparent in previous rounds. So Burns came to Cairo with a proposal in hand. He presented it to the Israelis. It was presented through some intermediary to Hamas. And that's where things kind of died, or at least appear to have died. I guess there's still some consideration. Hamas issued a statement on Tuesday that said, it wasn't happy with the proposal, but it was considering it and would prepare a response. I'm sure the Israelis will not be happy with that response, and, you know, round and round will go. But the holdup here, seems to be a couple of holdups. One still is the duration of the ceasefire. Hamas wants 6 weeks with a pathway to a full ceasefire. The Israelis want 6 weeks and we're done back to fighting. But the other problem, which may be more intractable at this point, is the issue of hostages. The Israeli government is demanding, and what's in this proposal from Burns in the U.S., the Biden administration, is that Hamas will release 40 living Israelis who are being held hostage in Gaza. The problem is Hamas now, it's been suspected for some time that this was the case, or there have been hints at it for some time, but they've now openly admitted that they don't have 40 living hostages anymore who fall into the category envisioned, or the categories, I should say, envisioned by the ceasefire proposal, which is women. Essentially women and elderly and or infirm men. So to get to 40 hostages, they would maybe have to dip into the sort of male Israeli soldier category, which they've been unwilling to do. They've wanted to extract additional concessions from the Israelis in return for that category of hostage. So that's a big sticking point. It raises a lot of concerns, not just for the ceasefire talks. I mean, if this is if that many hostages have died that they can't get to 40 in this, you know, in the category that's laid out in the proposal, that's kind of frightening in terms of just how many hostages have actually died, and we don't have great insight into that, obviously, because nobody's in Gaza kind of keeping track of these people except for Hamas, which isn't really talking. So that's very troubling. As I said, maybe the thing that prevents a ceasefire from being agreed. There's still a lot of pressure here to try and get a deal done. I think the U.S. in particular is applying pressure because it views a ceasefire as the only way to forestall this Iranian attack that may be coming. The Iranians have allegedly, through back channels, communicated a sense that if a ceasefire was agreed, they would temper or maybe even hold off altogether in a retaliation. So there's still a lot of pressure to try and get a deal done. I just don't know if it's feasible at this point.
Very, very grim stuff, Derek. Let's talk about the IDF withdrawal.
Yes, on Sunday, the IDF withdrew its forces from Khan Yunis, which leaves it with only one unit. I've seen it described as a brigade or a division. I'm not sure which. In the territory, in Gaza at all. It's occupying this Netzarim corridor that the IDF has created to bisect Gaza into northern and southern parts. There was some, you know, flurry of interest in this earlier in the week that, maybe this means, you know, the conflict is shifting, that the Israelis are, going to reduce the intensity of their operations, I guess, with the, you know, consequent reduction in casualties that might have ensued. Again, as a result of the WCK incident, as a result of this regional tension, as a result of the Biden administration, at least for a few days, seeming to express a lot of outrage in a very short period of time at a higher level than it's previously done with respect to Israel. Again, I think that's all performative, but take that for what it's worth. These things all sort of coincided. The Israelis have characterized the withdrawal as a chance to give those soldiers a rest, to refit their equipment, et cetera, before they head into Rafah. They're still insisting that they're planning a full-scale ground assault in Rafah. Benjamin Netanyahu even said that he's got a date, that the IDF has given him a date for that attack. He obviously didn't say what that date was. It may still be a ways off. The Israelis continue to insist that they're going to try to evacuate civilians out of Rafah before they go in, which would take weeks, and they haven't started. So, realistically, if they're going to do that or even make it what appears to the outside world to be a good faith attempt at doing it, they're going to need some time for that before they're ready to go in. So I really don't know where that stands. The withdrawal did allow for a few things. It allowed Palestinians who have been displaced from Khan Yunis to Rafah to return to Khan Yunis. Most of them, maybe all of them, for all I know, found that their homes had been completely destroyed by the IDF, so they couldn't stay. But they might have been able to take a few belongings or something like that. So there was a bit of a temporary relocation, at least. I don't think it lasted.
But it's worth mentioning also that these humanitarian trucks are also accompanied by trucks that are guided and delivered to the commercial sector and to the private sector here in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. But none of these humanitarian convoys had been given the access to reach to the northern part of Gaza Strip, despite the Israeli military decision to reopen again the areas of crossing and to guarantee further flow of humanitarian supplies to people in the north.
The other concern, of course, is for humanitarian aid. The Israelis have been citing higher numbers of trucks coming into the territory, I guess, again, in response to the pressure that they feel they've been under. They're disputing this with the United Nations, which has noted this week that the Israelis, when they talk about like 400 trucks came in today or 450 trucks came in today, the trucks are apparently half full because the Israeli, the IDF insists on that. So what's actually getting to the UN, the number of trucks, once they get into Gaza, they're unpacked and then loaded onto, reloaded, repacked and sent onto UN warehouses in Gaza. What's actually getting to those warehouses is about half the number of trucks that the Israelis say they are letting in. So it's a bit of a sleight of hand trick, I think, the Israelis say they're letting 400 trucks in. That's probably 200 trucks worth of aid, which 400 at this point would not be adequate to try and fend off the famine that is taking place in Gaza. 200 certainly is far below that. So there's a dispute about just how much aid is coming in and whether this withdrawal is actually allowing for any additional aid. The Israelis have promised to open new checkpoints and do all these things to try and enhance the humanitarian access to Gaza. I think that has yet to manifest in any real action.
Thanks, Derek. Could you give us an update on what's going on in Myanmar, where rebels have seized a key border town?
Yes, all week it's been reported that the rebel Karen National Liberation Army, alongside People's Defense Force militia fighters, the People's Defense Force, the Karen National Liberation Army is a longstanding ethnic rebel group that's been, you know, at war with the Myanmar government for a long time. The People's Defense Forces are these local militias that cropped up all over the country after the coup that put the military back in power a couple of years ago. They are not, at least nominally, connected through the opposition National Unity Government, the government in exile. But, you know, they I think function largely autonomously, and they work often with these ethnic rebel groups that have been at this a longer period of time, have more capacity, etc. So anyway, the Karen National Liberation Army and People's Defense Force militia fighters have been assaulting the town of Miyawadi, which is located in along the Myanmar-Thailand border. It's the largest commercial crossing point along that border. And it seems as of Thursday that they have finally taken the town. Now, they had been reporting mass surrenders by hundreds of Myanmar soldiers. Hundreds more soldiers and others have reportedly crossed the border into Thailand. The Thai government has been setting up or trying to set up some capacity for dealing with these people as they flee the fighting. The junta, the Myanmar government, the military junta, has said it's sending aircraft to Thailand to pick these people up and take them back to Myanmar. But for several days, there was still resistance despite these mass surrenders and evacuations. There had still been some resistance by a small, relatively small Myanmar military unit, plus the military was conducting airstrikes and that sort of thing. So that finally seems to have broken down on Thursday, with the military unit that was still defending Miyawadi fleeing across the border to Thailand and rebels apparently getting into the town. As I say, this is the largest commercial crossing on the Thailand border. It is a huge loss for the junta commercially and just in terms of this kind of never-ending seeming parade of losses that they've now suffered at the hands of the rebels, which is have been largely focused on the Chinese and Thai borders. So that's cutting revenue off from the junta, which will only increase its difficulties in terms of fielding an army and trying to defend itself or to take back territory.
American Prestige is brought to you in partnership with The Nation magazine. Please consider becoming a subscriber at americanprestigepod.com/subscribe. As a subscriber, you'll get access to dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, including breaking news specials, deep dives into regional histories, analysis of movies and video games, and much more. And if you subscribe at the founders level, you'll be able to claim a year digital subscription to The Nation. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
Let's talk about Sudan, where the Iranian drones have shifted what's going on the battlefield.
There was a story in Reuters this week about the apparent influx of Iranian-made drones that the Sudanese military has acquired. I think we talked a couple of weeks ago about the fact that the Sudanese military had made some rare gains at the expense of the Rapid Support Forces Group. The RSF has been, for most of their conflict, which is reached a full year at this point, has been driving the conflict. Its fighters are more seasoned, typically, than Sudanese military personnel, and it's been able to make up for deficiencies in things like air power and artillery power with its own drones that are allegedly probably being provided by the UAE. What's happened in the last month, give or take, I guess, is that the military has made some significant gains, particularly in the capital region, in the city of Omdurman, which is the sister city of the capital, Khartoum. And that's apparently, according to this Reuters piece, at least in large part because of these Iranian drones. They've been using them mostly, I think, for reconnaissance. So it's been they've been able to get more accurate information to target their artillery at RSF fighters. And that seems to be making a fairly significant difference. I think, unfortunately, for the Sudanese people who really could just do with this war ending full stop like yesterday, I suspect that this revelation that the Iranians are building a relationship with the Sudanese military that could potentially translate into an Iranian influence in Sudan after the war, that's only going to make the UAE panic and kind of probably increase its support for the RSF. And all this outside support at this point just does is extends the war. It extends the capacity of these two groups to keep fighting each other. And that's really the last thing that that the civilians need there.
Let's turn to Ukraine, and let's start with this brutal attack on a major power plant. It seems like Russia has struck within Ukraine.
Yeah, so an overnight Russian drone slash missile strike has destroyed the Trapilska plant, which is the largest power plant in the Kyiv region and surrounding regions. It, as far as I know, has just completely shattered the facility. That power plant supplies power to millions of people who are potentially at risk of losing power. Apparently, they've been able to, the Ukrainians have been able to take some steps to compensate right now, because you know, we're not yet in the sort of summer months where everybody's got their air conditioning on and the demand is you know, at its highest. So they've been able to compensate somewhat and keep people from entirely losing power. Although there have been other strikes against energy infrastructure in other parts of Ukraine that have left people without electricity. This seems like just a return to what the Russians were doing last year, sort of over the summer and leading into winter. There were a lot of these heavy bombardments of infrastructure, power and heat facilities in an effort to sort of leave civilians in the dark, leave, you know, kind of undercut capacity for heating, you know, leading into the winter. And also the size of these barrages suggests that they are an attempt to test, let's say, or deplete Ukraine's air defense systems. So you just throw up a lot of stuff and force the Ukrainians to shoot it down with anti-aircraft interceptor ammunition that they are running out of, because support from the U.S. and the West is not coming in the way that it once was.
Speaking of that, I think let's turn to an issue that was sadly predictable from the beginning, which is that the Ukraine parliament has passed a new conscription law.
Yes. The law is it was just passed on Thursday. I'm still sort of reading about it. It gives the military greater ability to identify, register and identify potentially fighting age men. It requires all men from 18 to 60 to carry to register with the military and carry documents showing apparently that they have registered, so that they can be checked by Ukrainian authorities at will. They will use this, or they may use this, I guess, information. You know, it seems obvious to identify military eligible men, and that's anybody from 25 and up, that the Ukrainians have just recently actually reduced the minimum age for service from 27 to 25. So they will, you know, use these documents to sort of identify anybody who is maybe trying to dodge the draft, I guess, or get out of military service. Obviously, you know, the Ukrainians are struggling to keep up with the Russians in terms of manpower. They're going to continue indefinitely to struggle to keep up with the Russians in terms of manpower. You know, this is another way to try and enforce conscription rules. But there is, you know, sadly a real risk that eventually an entire generation of Ukrainian men is going to be thrown into this war. You know, I suspect the reducing the conscription age to 25 is only the first step of what will be more adjustments to that age to come. And you're just going to see more and more people thrown into this war with, you know, not suggesting there's a better way. I don't know what I would do in this situation, but there just doesn't seem to be much to look for here on the horizon in terms of an end to this.
Pretty sad and tragic news as usual, Derek. Why don't we talk about Ecuador? And actually, there's been this raid on the Mexican embassy in Quito. Derek, do you think that a norm has actually changed here, or is these just two semi-random attacks soon after one another?
Yeah, I mean, I they're different enough that I don't know that you can connect the two. And I know you're talking about the Damascus attack by the Israelis. So there's what the Ecuadorian government did on Friday. Let's say that first. They raided the Mexican embassy in Quito to extract former Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass, who was facing corruption charges. He claims they're politically motivated. He was seeking asylum. The Mexican government earlier in the day on Friday had granted his request for asylum, and then the Ecuadorians went in and pulled him out. What's different is that the big kind of inviolable principle in international law with respect to diplomatic facilities has to do with host countries' responsibility to protect the sanctity of an embassy or a consulate. So what the Israelis did when they attacked this apparent Iranian consular building in Damascus didn't actually rise to that level. It didn't rise to that level of significance because it was a third party. It was an attack on a third party, you know, in a third state, whatever, diplomatic facility, which is not great. And those facilities still have the same protections under international law that any quote unquote civilian facility is supposed to have. But it's not the same as going into an embassy in your own country and conducting a raid like this, which is really just like you've thrown the rule book out the window. So I don't know that one necessarily has anything to do with the other. But yes, I mean, you could certainly say there's a pattern here of disrespecting the sort of protections or sanctity of diplomatic facilities.
If I stand for anything, Derek, it's the sanctity of diplomatic facilities.
I think we all should do that. But to say, you know, there's been a huge outcry now against Ecuador for having done this. The Mexican government cut off relations. I think the Organization of American States just voted to sort of condemn the raid. The United States, even, which has no real truck with the Mexican government, but does like Daniel Noboa, the president of Ecuador, because he's a good businessman, banana kingpin, apparently, good business, pro-business guy. So we like him. But nevertheless, the United States criticized the raid, suggested that it did, in fact, breach the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which is supposed to govern these things and obliges host countries to respect the integrity of embassies. So there's been a lot of outcry.
On Sunday, Mexican diplomats returning back home to an outpour of support, as Mexican officials say their embassy in Ecuador will remain closed indefinitely.
Mexico is now even asking the United Nations effectively to kick Ecuador out. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's how far things have gotten. And we've even seen a number of Latin American countries, even countries that you would normally expect to kind of line up on Ecuador's side here. If we view Mexico as this repository of dirty leftism and Ecuador as a repository of good, solid pro-business conservatism, even the pro-business conservative governments in Latin America seem to be kind of shying away from this and criticizing the Ecuadorian government for what it's done.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about the new Cold War, because Joe Biden has just had a meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, as well as the president of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos. Is Junior actually part of his name, or we just call him that?
No, he's Ferdinand Marcos Jr.
Okay, yes, Ferdinand Marcos Jr.
Or
so
bong,
what
bong.
Went on there?
I just kind of dropped the bong bong thing, which I have to give him credit for because that was dumb. But anyway, yeah, so Biden brought Kishida to the White House on Wednesday for a formal state visit. They had discussions all day on expanding, strengthening U.S.-Japanese relations, particularly on the military front. There was a discussion about forming some kind of joint regional air defense system with Japan, the U.S., and Australia being involved. There was talk of upgrading the U.S.-Japanese military alliance to put it, let's say, on par with the U.S.-South Korean command. Part of this is sort of meant to, from Kishida's perspective, sort of meant to kind of ratify his efforts to upgrade the Japanese self-defense forces, you can put that in quotes, into something more resembling a traditional military, which, of course, after World War II, we decided Japan shouldn't really have one of those. But I guess we're going back on that now. So they did have this discussion. There were reports a few days ago, the Financial Times, I think, was the first to report this, that they were going to discuss, and I don't know if they did. I don't actually know if this was part of the discussion, but the Financial Times reported that they were going to discuss expanding AUKUS, which, Danny, I know is one of your favorite alliances, the U.S., U.K., Australia.
It's among my favorite, not my favorite.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, okay.
I mean,
that was negotiated a while ago, was supposed to, it's organized around the idea of providing nuclear powered submarines, attack submarines to Australia. But there are other aspects of it. There's a whole second chapter of AUKUS that involves collaboration on other military technologies that supposedly, again, according to the Financial Times, the US, UK, and Australia want to open up to other partners. So the submarine part would just be the three of them, but this other aspect of the deal, they would open up to potential other partners, Japan being you know, sort of top of the list, I guess, to get into this thing. On Thursday, the two, Kishida and Biden, got together again, and this time they were joined by the president of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. This is the first time, apparently, that those three countries have all gotten together. Leaders of those three countries have all gotten together at the same time for a joint summit. I have not yet seen any sort of readout as we're recording this about what was discussed, but I'm sure of two things. I'm sure that one, they're going to mostly talk about China, and two, they will insist after they're done that they didn't talk about China. That's the way these things tend to go.
Well, Derek, thank you. And we're coming to the end of our show, and I'm sure you'll leave us on a happy note. You know, things could get better if we just work together. So why don't you tell us about what's going on with the climate?
Yes, we did it again. I mean, we did it again. I wasn't sure we could keep it going. But according to the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service, March last month was the hottest March ever recorded. It was a tenth of a degree higher than the previous record, which was set in March 2016. And this means for 10 months in a row now, we have had the hottest, whatever month that is, ever recorded. So hottest March, hottest February, hottest January, December, et cetera, going all the way back. They also, Copernicus also found that the 12-month period from April 2023 through March of this year set a new 12-month heat record. That topples the previous record, which had been set in March when they decided that the 12-month period from March last year to February this year was the hottest 12-month period on record. It will probably be broken next month once we have April's average temperature data, although there is some reason to think this streak may be breaking soon because El Nino that's been partly driving this, along with obviously the effects of man-made climate change, is apparently going to fade away and may turn into a La Nina, which is the cooling effect, later this year. So we may see a break in these hottest month ever records. But you know, I'm proud of us. We got 10 months in a row. I'm hoping we can make it to a full year.
You know, one of the good things is when the earth cooks, people don't have to pay back their student loans. So you got to look on the bright side. That's what I always say.
Yeah, well, it's just lots of things. Yeah, you know, throw your mortgage away.
Who cares?
Loans. It's all going to break down. So, you know, why not?
Well, on that happy note, see you all soon. Bye.
Bye.